I'm sorry, Zach. Are you ready? Open the House Meeting on Committee Service, Human Services.
Just apologize.
Friday, March 27, 2009. Colleagues, we're not going to be hearing House Bill 3018. We're going to be carrying that over. And I think we have Representative, what is your name? Sarah Gilfoot here. Who will be talking with us about House Bill 2442 and is going to tell us about her amendments. And she's given us some information that I think was sent to all of your offices. I hope you've had a chance to look at them. Would you come forward, please, and just quickly, very, very quickly, take us through the amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Gelser, which you probably don't know because I never come to this committee to bother you. And I'm hopeful that soon we'll pass this bill out of the committee and you won't have to talk to me anymore. I would, rather than going through the amendments, which we did the other day, I just wanted to take the opportunity to answer any questions that you have. And just also briefly to remind you that this is a bill that has been worked on for the better part of 18 months by dozens and dozens and dozens of people. And I sat this morning to try to start to estimate. I would bet that you have upwards of 1,000 people hours that have been put into the development of this bill. I'd heard some concern that it's a big bill and it was important to pore over it with a great deal of detail and a fine-tooth comb. I would assure you that in the -9 amendments, the details were so great that one of the requests was regarding the placement of a comma. So the attention to detail in this bill has been great, and it brings with it the support of all of the people that have to live with it.
Great. And tell us some of the people who were involved in this group, work group that you had.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There have been a couple of phases of this. You all remember, those of you who are on the interim committee, the work that we did on this. So many of you were involved in this initially. We then worked with the labor unions, including AFSCME and SEIU, obviously the Department of Human Services, including Seniors with People and Disabilities, the Office of Investigations and Training, the Office of Addictions and Mental Health, and a number of their legislative coordinators. We've worked with the counties and individuals from local counties. We have worked with district attorneys and the District Attorney Association. We have worked with county sheriffs and the County Sheriffs Association. We have worked with protective service workers from individual communities. We have worked with defense attorneys. We have worked with prosecutors. And we have worked with the Governor's Commission on Seniors, the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, the Oregon Community Providers Association. I'm starting to lose all of the lists, but literally dozens and dozens of people. Last fall, I went out and did about 25 different presentations to different organizations that led to significant revisions to the bill while it was in the process of being drafted, because we took input at each of those places. I don't believe there is anyone who would be impacted by this bill in terms of its implementation that is not overly aware of it and has been exhausted from the conversation of it. And I just really want to thank the people that continue to work on this, individual advocates as well. It's been an enormous amount of work. The department in particular, over the course of the last 6 weeks, has just been such a champion in devoting their time and the work particularly of Fred Steele, who's one of their policy analysts that worked directly with Lori to get the language right. I think this is a very well-crafted bill that meets the needs and concerns that have been raised over the period of time. It's time to move it. It's something really positive that we can do this session that's going to make people safer. So in the end, I would say it's not just this bill that deserves your support. It's the workers in the community and, most importantly, the vulnerable adults that need our protection. They deserve our support this time. They don't deserve another session to pass with our saying, wait till next time.
Great. Thank you, Representative Gelser. My intent is to pass the -2, the -7, and the -9 amendments. And if there is any discussion about any of that, we can entertain it right now. But that is what I'd like to do this morning. Any discussion, any questions of Representative Gelser before we move on?
Yeah, Representative, just one comment, Madam Chair. Thank you. And thank you for all the work you did since Wednesday. in going back through and collating and all that stuff. I appreciate that work.
Great. Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? And again, thank you for all your work. So I have opened up a hearing. Now I'm closing the hearing and opening up a work session on House Bill 2442. And Representative Boone.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated March 17th, the -7 amendments dated March 19th, and the -9 amendments dated the March the 23rd, all of 2009.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Boone moves to adopt the -2, the -7, and the -9 amendments. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So moved. Or so done. The amendments are adopted. And colleagues, we're still waiting for the fiscal, and so we'll hopefully have it by Monday, and if so, we'll try to move this bill on Monday. We'll carry the work session over to Monday. Thank you. So we'll close the work session on today, Friday the 27th. And now we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2351.
House Bill 2351 requires hospitals use evidence-based and best practices from the fields of mental health, trauma, and emergency medical services in the treatment of individuals with mental illness. It requires that the Department of Human Services make rules establishing standards designed to provide individuals with mental health issues safe and effective care in hospitals.
Thank you. So we have several people who signed up to testify. I would have Ellen Lowe and Dave. Ellen, come here a minute, would you please? We'll have a 30-second recess. Could you turn off the mic, please? The meeting again, and Jesse Willis, Bob Junedeff, and Becky Child, please. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedeff. I'm the director of Disability Rights of Oregon, and we are the protection advocacy organization for the state of Oregon. Part of our job is to protect the rights and advocate the rights of people with mental illness, particularly those who are in institutions across the state of Oregon. We're here today with a bill that is addressing an issue that is longstanding in Oregon. And I just want to give you a very brief explanation of why we're here. In our mental health system, we have a whole variety of pieces. We have a community system. We have a state hospital. We also rely upon private hospitals to provide emergency services when there is an acute episode that a person is suffering from a crisis in which they may be dangerous to themselves or others or need inpatient psychiatric care. Now, the way we have things arranged in Oregon, should a person be having that experience, should they have been come into contact with a police officer, or should they on their own or with the help of a family member need inpatient psychiatric care, emergency psychiatric care, their door to that care comes at a private hospital, almost in all cases. And the road into the private hospital is normally the emergency room. So a person will come to an emergency room and present themselves and explain their need. Now, because of the way we have things structured, there are only so many inpatient psychiatric beds that are available in Oregon in private hospitals. And so when a person comes to the emergency room, they are assessed there, and then a decision needs to be made as to whether that person needs further psychiatric care. And if there's an assessment that they do, then the next step is to locate a bed on a psychiatric ward for that person to receive that care. Now, the hospital that the person has arrived at may have its own psychiatric ward, may not. That psychiatric ward, in many cases, may be full if it does have its own ward. In any case, the normal process is then for the administrators and the physicians and so forth to find a bed. This can sometimes take hours, it can sometimes take days, and if depending upon how busy things are at that particular point in time. Because of our system is chronically overloaded, it oftentimes can take days. And that means that person who's experienced a psychiatric emergency stays in the emergency room for quite a period of time. In these instances, there are standards that exist. All hospitals, of course, are licensed, and there are federal standards from the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services that govern how folks are supposed to be treated while they're in the emergency room. However, our state does not have any direct standards of regulation for how a person is treated while they're in that location. While the state governs all of the standards for community mental health, it governs all the standards for residential services and for outpatient services and for state hospital services, this is a particular gap in state oversight of how folks are treated in the system, and yet it is an area that, as I said, we've relied upon to provide services, a key element of services, really the front door for most people to mental health services in Oregon. In the written materials that I have provided you, I quote from a variety of policy papers that have been produced in Oregon over the last 10 years, highlighting the fact that that we have a problem in Oregon in terms of our reliance upon emergency rooms and private hospitals where people get backed up, where they are unable to proceed on to receive the care that they need in that most vulnerable moment in their illness, which is their point of crisis. This is not a new problem. Now, we, and by we, I mean our organization and consumers and families, have brought this issue forward, obviously through channels of government, but also directly with hospital administrators, and you'll hear from them today. I mean, we've had very good conversations with those who administer the hospitals. And frankly, they say the same thing that we know, which is that they have a lack of resources to provide these services, that that there are limitations in beds. They want to be able to move people to the most appropriate level of service as quickly as they can, and yet they have restrictions to do so because of limitations that in availability. Really, the disagreement, that, if you will, that we may have is that our feeling is that the state should step up and recognize this level of service as part of the continuum of service and have some standards that apply to how people are treated in the emergency rooms. And as you will hear from representatives of hospitals, I believe they'll tell you that they feel that they're fully regulated already and that state regulation would be redundant. Our feeling is that we would like the state of Oregon to really take ownership of this part of the continuum of services. And you'll hear from consumers today about experiences that they've had. Now, I'm not here to tell you, I'm not here to assert that this is every experience, but It's here to highlight, they're here to highlight to you that problems happen when you have a person who's in a psychiatric crisis who ends up in an emergency room and stays in a room by themselves for days on end waiting for that next level of service. Not one that anybody wants, not that one that anybody desires, but it does happen. And we would like to see some basic standards that they can look to that give them some sense of protection in that environment, and also to have a place to go if they have a concern or a complaint. I've worked in this area a long time, and I can tell you that just because there are CMS standards doesn't mean that there's an avenue to complain about those standards. CMS is a long ways away, and they have a lot to do, and they are not responsive to individual, in my experience at least, individual types of
complaints. Remind us what CMS is.
The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which is part of the federal government that provides standards for medical programs that accept federal money for health insurance. So with that, I'm going to hand it to my other panelists who will tell you more about their personal experiences and those of their peers.
Thank you, John. Any quick questions, John, before we move on?
Just real quick, and I know you're trying to get through this. Thank you. I'm new at this, so I need to understand. You're talking about wanting to have a kind of a framework of what we're going to allow or need for care in emergency rooms. Who pays for the care? Does the state pay for it already, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, right now, if a person is placed on state law, there's a civil commitment process, and there is a person can be placed on a hold, which means they can't leave voluntarily. They have to receive observation and evaluation to determine whether they should go through a civil commitment process, which is a court process to determine whether they need to receive involuntary mental health services. During that hold period, the government is supposed to pay for the time that the person is in the hospital. Now, I'm sure, as you'll hear later, the reimbursement rate is not adequate to cover the hospital's costs, and sometimes I understand the hospital will not even proceed to collect that fee, but there is some government money that goes for that service.
All right, thank you.
Excellent question, Representative.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Willis, and I'm a mental health consumer. And I'm not going to get to the nitty-gritty of the bill. I'd rather talk about my experience to let you know sort of the realities of what can happen in the emergency room. I think that this bill is common sense. It gives mental health consumers their dignity and respect that's often stripped away when they come in.
Could you tell us your experience?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. I had an incident where I was very suicidal, and I promised my psychiatrist. I had called him up, and I said, I feel like I want to commit suicide, and he said, go to the emergency room. However, I stopped off at Albertsons and got a bottle of Tylenol PMs, and I took the whole bottle while I was at the store. I then panicked and went to the emergency room, and it was hitting me very hard, and I could hardly walk, could hardly talk. And I told them, I said, I just took a whole bottle of Tylenol PMs. I really need to be seen. And they said, wait in the waiting room, and we'll see what we can do. And so I waited for almost an hour in the waiting room at the emergency room until they finally got me back. And when they got me back into the bed, they said I had to take my clothes off. And I was getting sicker and sicker as this was going on. And I actually had to lay there naked while they pumped my stomach
They wouldn't even give me a gown. It took away my dignity. It almost ended my life. And after that experience, I've been terrified to go to the emergency room. There is also another incident, too, where, again, I was very suicidal, and I went in to try to get some help. And what happened was, I thought, completely ridiculous. I was first seen by a doctor, and I told him that I felt like killing myself. And he said, well, I don't really deal with that. We'll send somebody else in. And so another person came in that was supposed to be a nurse that dealt with mental health issues. And she talked to me for a while, and she said, well, I don't really deal with this either. So she brought in another person and another person. I saw about 5 or 6 people, and I had to keep retelling my story. I had just gone through a rape, and I had to keep telling it to everybody. And I just felt awful. It made my anxiety worse. It made me feel more traumatized from having to retell the story of how I was attacked. I was already just on the verge of, you know, going over the edge. I was terrified, and having to relive it over and over through telling all these people my story actually made me a lot worse than when I had first arrived. I feel like with this bill, we could get that dignity back. We could be treated with respect. And that's sort of the point that I wanted to make, is that, you know, just because I have a mental illness doesn't mean that I should have to be treated badly. And that's what I hope that you can take away from my testimony.
Thank you so much for coming to tell us your story today. Thank you. Thank you. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you. Good morning, Madam Chair, fellow committee members. My name is Becky Child. I am Board President of Mental Health America of Oregon. I also have been hospitalized more than 20 times, many of those times going through the emergency department. Fortunately, that's not had to happen for several years now. However, when it was happening, I finally made the decision that I could no longer be hospitalized in the state of Oregon because I'd had so many negative experiences through the emergency department, and I began going out of state when I needed to be psychiatrically hospitalized. And I found a hospital up in Washington that provided the kind of care that I needed and treated me with dignity and respect. The testimony that I have given you has several quotes from people who I've spoken with. They're the italicized pieces of the testimony, who talked about what their experiences were in the ED and how they had been treated. And I'll let you read those for yourself. However, our Mental Health America's broad position is to support House Bill 2351. The President's New Freedom Commission report states that it takes 15 to 30 years to move best practice research into actual service delivery. One example of this is trauma-informed care. It's widely acknowledged that a large percentage of approximately 90 to 95% of people who use publicly funded mental health services have experienced trauma in their lives. Sometimes this trauma is from the treatment that they have received. And this can manifest in self-injury or other behavior that emergency departments may find difficult to respond to in an effective manner, or that the individual receiving treatment feels that she or he was treated with dignity and respect and not devalued or denigrated. People experiencing mental health crises frequently report being treated disrespectfully and without dignity when they report to the ED. The end result is tragic for everyone. Individuals receiving mental health crises are experiencing mental health crises, feel devalued, and less capable of engaging in recovery. ED personnel report feeling more frustrated, callous, and demoralized. The entire healthcare system suffers when people do not receive the right care at the right time. This is particularly true for individuals that have survived traumatic experiences. Fortunately, great advances in trauma-informed care have emerged in the past 5 years. In addition, there are multiple models that promote respectful interactions between individuals experiencing mental health crises and ED personnel. By implementing these best practices, EDs would be able to better meet the needs and facilitate better outcomes of individuals experiencing mental health crises. The precedent for this bill was established when Senate Bill 267 passed in 2003, which successfully required the implementation of the use of evidence-based practices in both the Department of Corrections and the Mental Health Division. This bill allows hospitals and EDs to choose which practices and processes that will provide evidence-based care that will meet the needs of their population. This bill does not create a mandate for particular practices. MHAO would be willing to help facilitate the selection of practices or participate in any conversation around that if it was needed. The bill promotes the integration of different elements of the community continuum of care for persons with mental illness. Current efforts to promote integration of care must happen at every level of care. And I believe that the Hospital Association may say that that we really need to have more funds in the community and have a community-based system of care. I wholeheartedly agree with that. However, we have what we have right now, and this is to try and address problems that we have right now. And waiting until we have a better funded mental health system and community-based care is going to cause a lot of people a lot of pain if we don't act on this bill. So if there's any questions you have, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Becky. Any quick questions of this panel? All right. Thank you all very much. So I'd like to hear from Grant Higginson, Jim Anderson. Can we get four people up there? Ellen Lowe, Dave Fiscom. Can we bring up another chair there? Is that feasible? Or does somebody...
Pardon? I'll just wait for him.
Okay. Grant can come last.
Yeah. You want to I'm just trying to help Grant here.
I know. That's always appreciated.
Madam Chair, Jim Anderson with the Oregon chapter of the emergency physicians. We have a larger chapter, the American College of Emergency Physicians. We're here today, and thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, and your staff, both your office staff and committee staff, for granting some time before this bill, or at least giving me some heads up on this bill before it was heard today, to get one of my doctors here, a constituent of Representative Mowers from Rogue Valley, Dr. Mike McCaskill. He did not make it today.
Oh.
He called me at 5:30 this morning. He is in the second shift in 24 hours. I think he forgot about spring break. But anyway, he was to be here to testify. I am going to try to handle that for him. And just to let you know that our organization, OSEP, cannot support this bill as written. However, we do understand, and you just heard the reasons why something needs to be done with mental health patients when they enter the emergency department setting. There's nothing in this bill that changes the way things are done now. And the bill tries to legislate medical practice. This is a puzzle to us. It continues through throughout the legislative process that medical practice tries to be legislated, and it's not a good practice to get into. Emergency physicians always try to do their best to protect the dignity and safety of those with a mental illness. We just heard of an incident that happened, and unfortunately, these incidents probably take place more often than the people who testified before us would admit to. The emergency department setting, however, and a bill like this is not the way to take care of the issue. The tort system can also take care of any injustice that a patient might feel is or has been done to them. Putting in writing what we have as evidence-based practices, which is on line 7 of the bill, is ambiguous, and we don't feel it can be enforced. It raises many questions. First of all, whose evidence is it? what evidence is considered good, what isn't worth considering, and is any evidence acceptable. Physicians also disagree on whether they should rely on evidence-based medicine, consensus medicine, experimental medicine, etc. Basically, how physicians practice medicine is a purview of each physician. It's an art and not a science. Cut to the chase, I guess, what I would like to say, and then we can get to the individuals on my left. During this past interim, August, I believe it was, Representative Cowan and you, Madam Chair, accompanied me to locations around the state. We went to Newport, Representative Cowan, and Madam Chair, we went to Providence, Milwaukee. And you got to see firsthand what happens in an emergency setting. And I think in each instance, we also got a chance to observe psychiatric care facilities and beds at those locations. In Newport, it was a reduced number. Providence, Milwaukee was a greater number. It varies from hospital to hospital, from emergency department to emergency department. The previous people testifying were right. These facilities need to improve. In my doctor's, my physician's view, there's far too few beds to accommodate these people. But it's a sign of the times in Oregon. More and more mental health patients are presenting themselves to emergency departments today. It's a matter of fact in Oregon. We start hearing about prisoners and jails furloughing prisoners. These people hit the streets. A lot of these people have mental illness. Where do they have to go? Where do they have to turn? They probably don't have health coverage. They can't afford to see a psychologist or psychiatrist. They default to an emergency department. It overloads that department. That department then cannot see patients that have other types of medical problems that they need to have corrected and treated. So this problem needs to be addressed, and what I have handed out to you, and I think you have, is this piece of paper that I've highlighted a portion of. It comes from this report. This report is a 2009 report from the American College of Emergency Physicians. It grades each state as to the overall health, if you will, of the emergency medical system in that state. You can see Oregon's grade in the upper right-hand corner. It is not good.
Wow.
It is a D. And that the last time this report was given was 2006. The report is done from a blue ribbon panel of individuals outside of the American College of Emergency Physicians, made up of PhD professors, made up of people from the CDC, made up of doctors from the AMA. So it is a group of individuals who have no stake in emergency medicine directly. And they're given a set of principles and protocol to follow to come to their conclusions. In 2006, this was the baseline that was used for the 2009 report. Oregon was a C- in 2006. We have become a D, and in some areas we are completely failing. Something needs to be done to correct that. And the highlighted area speaks for itself. I won't go into that. I'll let you read that for yourself. But that addresses the issue that we're here to discuss today. Furthermore, my doctors wanted to bring a bill this session dealing with this issue. And we had a lot of internal discussions and decided not to, because we presented the issue, first of all, in bill draft or LC draft to the governor's office and then to DHS, Dr. Goldberg. And in both cases, they said, well, you know, we would like to have you do this. It would be probably not advisable this session because we just don't have the money to do what our bill wanted to do. And quite honestly, when we got down to the bottom line and polled our physicians throughout the state from emergency department to emergency department, we didn't find consensus that, for instance, downtown Portland, many of the hospitals in major metropolitan areas face a huge problem with the mentally ill. You get into areas like Pendleton, get into areas like any rural setting, it's reduced quite a bit. They have fewer psychiatric care facilities there also, but that's reflected on the number of mental ill patients they get. Is that number increasing in the rural setting? Yes, it is. But not as dramatically as the metropolitan areas. So we withdrew the idea of a bill and had further discussions with the governor's office and Dr. Goldberg. What Dr. Goldberg would like to do, and we are meeting with him next Friday, to begin the discussions to have a task force formed in DHS to cover everything that is on this page that you see that Oregon needs to correct with regard to emergency medical services. Dr. Higginson is invited. Various people from DHS are invited. The people that were here just testifying are truly invited to join in on this task force. We will first meet with Dr. Goldberg to see if he is still willing to do it. I hope that he is, and I hope that he's listening. And I also hope that we can get this off the ground and get it started and get down the road, because at the spearhead of this, I believe, and my doctors believe, is the mentally ill patient that comes into an emergency department. We need to correct that problem and other problems within emergency services. Now, I've gone on long enough. I know that David is anxious to testify.
I'm
sure we'll all stand for questions when we're
right,
there.
I'm going to hold questions until the whole panel has spoken. Thank you, Jim.
Madam Chair, good morning, committee members. For the record, Dave Fiskum here representing Providence Health System. I'm happy to be here, flanked by two of my colleagues. It's probably appropriate I'm to the left of Mr. Anderson and to the right of Ms. Lowe. Can't help but reflect on the fact that wearing various hats, Ellen and I have been around this healthcare process for too many years to count, and it's a pleasure to be here with her. I'll make just a few comments on behalf of one health system with seven hospitals in this state. You know Providence. Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you as I start for your visit to the Providence, Milwaukee earlier this year, or last year, I guess. We appreciated hosting you there to see how one hospital ED works, at least in a near-urban, if not urban, area. I want to just share with you some thoughts about what we're doing already to deal with this issue, which is a very tough one for all of us in Oregon's hospitals. I will refer to some comments that were prepared for me by Mr. Herb Ozer, who directs all mental health services for Providence Health System, and has some comments first in general and then in specific about how we handle mental health issues in our EDs. First of all, so I'll just forge ahead and be happy to try to answer questions at the end after Ms. Lowe speaks. Providence Behavioral Health Services offers a comprehensive range of therapy and counseling to help people recover and regain their lives. We have teams of mental health professionals who are dedicated to finding the best possible treatment for patients who experience mental illness. We offer a range of inpatient, outpatient, and residential care and services through our behavioral health program, including child and adolescent treatment. As for emergency department care, we've long supported and been concerned about the care that behavioral health patients receive when they enter an emergency department, perhaps with no other choice than to go there for care. Through the overall patient experience we have, EDs are not always the best place for somebody to receive care for mental illness. As the network of subacute behavioral health services in this state has decreased, hospital EDs have become, in some cases, and I think you've seen this if you've been in our facilities, de facto treatment locations for people experiencing a mental health crisis. In short, resources outside of acute care are today very scarce. here are four steps we've taken to attempt to deal with this issue as best we can within the limits that we have, and in fact you have. We've created specialty areas within our EDs to provide a calmer, more comfortable space for a person experiencing a mental health crisis. And that's not always easy to do in a crowded ER, but we have tried to do that in many of our hospitals. I've seen the one at Providence Portland Medical Center, the space reserved for this kind of calmer treatment, and it's at least a step above what otherwise somebody would face if they simply went to an ER, just generally. For some time, second, we've had a 24-hour, 7-day-per-week on-call availability for psychiatric consultations in our EDs. Thirdly, in addition to 24/7 on-call availability, we have, during the past 4 years, increased the amount of psychiatric consult time available in our EDs, currently providing 7 days a week, 8 hours a day. Psychiatrists are available for evaluation and treatment of patients whose psychiatric symptoms cannot be stabilized after initial emergent treatment. Fourthly, as the needs have been demonstrated, we've added even more staffing to build a stronger interdisciplinary team response to address the needs of behavioral health patients. Our emergency departments now have a psychiatric technician position. We've increased as well social work and nursing hours in an attempt to deal with the reality that we face. I would just say that in summary that our view is with all due respect to the proponents of this bill whose motives I don't question at all, I'm not sure this legislation is necessary. The risk, I think, that Mr. Anderson has described is that it might create a fiscal impact if it were to pass in its current form, which might be its death knell in the reality of the budget process you and we all face. And if there is an ability to create a task force that deals with these issues within DHS, and if I can put it this way, subject to Mr. Higginson or Dr. Higginson when he comes up, perhaps that can be absorbed within the DHS structure, given the priority attached to it, that would be a way to go to deal with this issue. And we'd be pleased, as would others, to participate in that process were it to exist. With that, Madam Chair, I'll stop and be happy to try to answer questions, though there are mental health professionals in the room far better able than I to do so if your questions are hard ones. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. And I see that you were reading some from some printed information. If you could give that to Zach, if it's something that we could reprint and pass to the
Madam Chair,
committee
let me
members.
Just tell you what I will do. The letter that Mr. Ozer had prepared for you was not yet final last night at 6 o'clock.
Okay.
They sent me an email draft of it so I could read these comments to
Great.
You. It'll be finalized later today or Monday morning, and we will get it to your staff for the committee.
Great.
For the record, so thank you for that request.
Thank you. Ellen, good to see you.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I serve as community advocate for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and also for the people we serve. Our 57 member hospitals and the 13 acute care psychiatric hospitals share so many of the concerns you have heard from the proponents today, and also that you have heard from Mr. Anderson from the emergency room physicians themselves. We do believe we have a broken system in terms of providing community mental health services. For too often, Oregonians who are living with a mental illness find few community support services that are there ready in a timely way. And so, as you heard, the emergency room too often becomes their only option for care. And when the nearest acute care hospital is full, and Mr. Jundeff alluded to some of this, then, and often it's full because of patients being diverted from one part of the state to another, then these patients then in turn may be diverted out of their community. And so one of the most important things for people who are living with mental illness is not to be separated from the community which they call home. And so the emergency room can be a life-saving location and service. But we acknowledge again that for the outcomes really to be healthy for the patient, there needs to be that continuum of care. And this is what led the Hospital Association, actually in 2006, to take the initiative to put together the Coalition for Community Mental Health Services. And they were very active in the last session and continue to be so. The association includes advocates. You heard from them today. They're part of this coalition. And we continue to be a very strong voice for an integrated mental health system. And as a result, all of us are going to be participating in stakeholder meetings next week. Those of you, and I know Chair Tomei has been part of the Ways and Means process. You know that Representative Kotek and Senator Bates have really initiated a process where we can look at revising our community-based system. I hesitate to call it a system. It's really more a pretense of one. And so it appears as if, and I have to say I have real faith in the leadership now for mental health within DHS. I have real faith that under the leadership and guidance of Dr. Harris, Richard Harris, that you are going to begin to see some real movement in terms of developing access for folks across the state to mental health services in a very timely way. And what is being talked about are some demonstration projects, because you heard about the Providence system in the Portland metropolitan area. The letter I have submitted to you from Robin Henderson talks about a very different part of the state. And so the needs could be very, very different there. But somehow it seems ill-timed to launch on a new effort to look at what really is the result of our lack of attention to community-based mental health services. And so we would be bifurcating our efforts. And rather than doing this, this is why at the Hospital Association we really are supportive of what is now being looked at within the Ways and Means process. I continue to learn from consumers and their families who are living with mental illness. And I'll share the information I heard today. I will continue to do so. And you will see that the Hospital Association will continue to give strong support to creating opportunities for the kind of dialogue, because no one wants to have the outcomes that we heard about today. Dr. Robin Henderson, who some of you have heard, who chairs our Oregon Psychiatric Inpatient Committee, really has been very involved in the Bend area, actually all of Eastern Oregon, in terms of trying to put together an integrated regional response. And again, because of the services provided in by our hospitals, we really in many ways are a beginning point for looking at the real integration of physical and mental health. And I'd just like to read part of Robin's letter to you. She writes, "Every day we receive calls from hospitals scattered across central and eastern Oregon, and they are our highest priority for placement because we know they don't have access to trained mental health professionals on site. We know that many of these hospitals are in counties that do not have the ability to have someone from the county come to assist in a timely fashion. We know they do not have the resources to even build or staff a safe room. And in most cases, it doesn't make sense for them to do so. These are not daily occurrences for them, but when they do happen, they want to get the person they are serving to the right level of care as quick as possible, and so do we. These hospitals are the lifelines of their communities, and some of you represent some of these areas. And we have made it our mission at St. Charles to support all of them with the most expeditious service we can to care for those suffering in a mental health crisis. We are staffed with those services that are on the cutting edge of a practice, a psychiatric emergency service with licensed, trained professionals on site, 24 hours a day, who are there to care for those we serve. We are the only hospital east of the Cascades with that availability. And that's okay, because we have the capacity, capability, and commitment to serve Central and Eastern Oregon. Robin also writes, creating another regulatory hoop for us to jump through isn't the way to go, and in the long run will cause all of us to focus on the broken system we have now rather than the future that we can build together. And again, what we can do in hospitals really is not going to have a lasting, satisfactory outcome unless it's linked to those wider services within the community. And that's where we encourage you to give your voice to what is now being discussed in Ways and Means. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Ellen. Any questions at this panel? Representative Matt Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I guess for me, this bill is simply another indication of our broken mental health system. And my question for Mr. Anderson is essentially, we have an overuse of the emergency room anyway because we have a number of people who don't have access to health care other than going to the emergency room. Is that a fair assessment?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, yes, it is. It's very fair, and it's not getting better, it's getting worse.
Representative Adembo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to get your sense of how this bill, if it were to pass, what kinds of practices it might lead to. I've heard some concern Mr. Anderson stated first. On its surface, the bill seems pretty innocuous to me, right? It's calling for evidence-based care and best practices. And it, just looking at it from a distance, abstractly, it's hard to see who could object to that. What kind of concerns do you have about the rulemaking that would presumably follow this would lead to inordinate burdens?
Madam Chair, Representative Dembro, I just told my colleagues I'll take the first crack at this one, but I think I tried to say in my testimony anyway that this bill in large part is redundant to what is already in rules, regulation, and the law. If they went into rulemaking in DHS, they could possibly go nowhere with this that hasn't already been thoroughly explored and vetted over many, many years of rulemaking and lawmaking by previous legislatures. So what is in the bill is something that can't be refuted. Yes, that these are things that should happen for a mentally ill patient, but it's already on the book. It's already in the OARs. It's already in statute. What needs to be done? and what is being done. The instances you heard today are unfortunate, and they, but needless to say, they do occur. Human frailties happen by professionals and by lay people. So I don't know how you're going to get around, I don't know how you're going to legislate something like that. But short answer, I think, and then I'll let Mr. Fiskum take a crack at it. This bill is truly pure redundancy.
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbrough, I'm not sure I have much to add. I would just, my first thought was going to be that if the Department of Human Services engages in rulemaking, that doesn't, that's not a foreboding prospect for us. We have a good relationship with them. We have input into the process. With Mr. Anderson, I believe that this bill doesn't necessarily change anything. There's lots of good stuff going on. There's lots of better stuff that should go on. And if I can draw your attention to two big picture issues, I would submit to you that beyond this bill, two things are very important. The first one I suspect some of you are already involved in and will continue to be involved in, and that is as the state makes investments within available resources, which are dropping in a mental health system and in new state institutions, you need to pay attention to community care at the same time, which is very, very difficult as the drivers exist to finance state institutions to improve the one down the street, which has gotten black marks. And the tension you're going to face is that you're going to be have a challenge of investing in more staff in an institution, a building, that you're probably going to tear down pretty soon to build new ones. And in all of that those dominant issues, which are genuine issues, and which is provinces supportive of dealing with those issues, and will be a part of that. Don't forget community care, the installation of community systems, which can be relieve the traffic that ends up in an ER because there's nowhere else to go. The second issue, Madam Chair, and I'll beg your indulgence for this. This isn't the magic answer, the magic bullet, but when I deal with issues like this on behalf of the health system, I can't help but say that one of the issues that this legislature or any legislature has within your control to deal with, at least in theory, I know I'm well aware with you of the extremity of our budget circumstance, which is the worst in my 30 years in state government. So with that, I'll say make the point. I would encourage you to consider funding Medicaid adequately. Fund the obligations you create adequately. One of the reasons people end up in ERs is because the state's mental Medicaid system is broken. And to Representative Freeman, not all of the people who come to an ER are Medicaid patients or clients, but those who are, you're paying 65% of a hospital's costs, and the same exists for other providers. And so we need to engage in genuine health care reform and finance the state's obligations. I could make the same point to the federal government about Medicare. The Medicare reimbursement rates for providers of all kinds are better than the state's. They're toward 90%, as Representative Maurer may know, given his experience. But state government pays 65%. And the burden gets shifted onto yours and my backs, and people lose coverage. And the upshot is, when there's nowhere else to go, people with no Medicaid coverage or limited Medicare coverage or no coverage at all end up in an ER, and that creates the glut, the traffic that makes it even more difficult than otherwise to treat mental health patients. So this is this bill is sort of a symptom of a far larger set of issues for you and for us who care about health care in Oregon.
Thanks, Dave. I think what I'm going to do is bring the department up, and we can see if we want to address further questions to the department, and we can bring up these three if there's any.
One quick comment. Mr. Anderson, in the National Report Card on State of Emergency Medicine, which is, you gave us one page, that is an excellent document. It's got a whole lot of information there besides just talking about emergency rooms. If you could forward that to the committee, that would be great.
Would you, Madam Chair?
No, not a book.
Not a book. But I think there are 100 data points in here for each state. From whether or not the state has a stroke system of care, I'm looking at it now, or a written plan is specifically for special needs patients. I mean, it's it's very interesting.
Good. And do send us the link to, we'll send it to Keeley and Keeley can send it.
I will, Madam Chair, and it just goes to show the Internet's a wonderful thing, especially when it's on the dais. But are you referring to the backside of this bill?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I want to point out also that this bill had originated in the Judiciary Committee. Hmm? I don't really know why that is, and I will find out by the next meeting. You know?
Madam Chair, the Judiciary Committee was the last committee open prior to pre-session filing.
Oh.
And so there were a bunch of bills that went to Judiciary.
Got it.
Is that showing up in all of my committees?
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Representative Van Orman?
But it might also be indicative of the fact that the county jails are full of people with mental health.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Grant, you get to
good morning,
follow
Chair.
Up all this.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I'm here basically to talk about what we would do should the bill pass at the Department of Human Services. As you know, the bill mandates evidence-based practices for individuals with mental illness when they are seen in emergency departments, and clearly the department supports the idea of providing high-quality care to all patients, and particularly those patients that are vulnerable, and clearly those patients with mental illnesses are some of our most vulnerable patients. The bill specifically requires that we adopt rules establishing the standards for that evidence-based care. And our Addictions and Mental Health Division are the people with the expertise in this area, and so they have agreed that they would pull together an expert advisory committee to help us in the development of those rules. And this would mean more than just having mental health professionals on that advisory committee. We would also include hospital administration, emergency department staff, emergency physicians, the ambulance agencies, as well as state agencies. So we always try to pull together a broad-based group when we're doing this kind of rulemaking process. In trying to get to some of the issues that Representative Dembro raised about what would come out of this, I clearly right now cannot say. I mean, we would take a look at what we currently have in our hospital rules. We would take a look at what there is in the way of evidence-based practices at emergency departments. And I am a firm believer in adopting evidence-based care when you have evidence-based care that you know about. And unfortunately, you know, some things there is very good evidence-based care, and that it is something that is cost-effective and cost-efficient to use. And in some places, we just don't have evidence-based care, or it's prohibitively expensive. So I don't know what would come out of the advisory committee recommendations, but we would certainly do our best to come up with something that is trying to promote the concepts of this bill. So we would have the rulemaking process, then my Office of Healthcare Licensing and Certification would adopt those proposed rules into our Oregon Administrative Rules, and at that point we would plan on checking that these practices are happening at emergency departments when we go out and do our regular surveys. The rulemaking process is part of state work, and so it would not be a fiscal impact. Adding this on to our routine survey practice would not again be a fiscal impact. We could do that within existing resources. If, however, the committee envisions a much more aggressive monitoring and regulatory scheme, that is something that we could not do within existing resources, and it is outside the governor's recommended budget. So I just needed to mention that.
Thank you, Grant.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Grant, so would it be possible for the department to do this without legislation being passed?
Chairman Tomei, if we were given directions to pull together an advisory committee to study the issue and report back to you, that is something that we could do, and it's something that if the advisory committee felt that administrative rules could be adopted, that is something we could do administratively.
I'd like the committee to think about that. Anytime we don't need to pass legislation, I'm really happy about that. So let's think about that before our next meeting and maybe discuss it with some of the other stakeholders if you have interest in that or concerns about that. Any questions? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Well, in this discussion this morning, it and I, of course, I like Representative Freeman, I'm new, but what I'm missing is a general overview of the mental health system in the state, and obviously we've got some serious problems with it, and if I have access to something so that it would help me understand.
I have books and books and books that have been given to me on the Ways and Means Committee that I would be delighted to share with you.
Okay.
But it's probably not an overview. We've gotten a brief overview early in the session, but I've gotten much more intense information in the Ways and Means Committee that
but
I would... But it's really not going to be in our purview in this committee to reform...
Precisely.
...the that agency.
But it appears that the Ways and Means is looking at the issues relative to the delivery of mental health.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Comey?
I mean, you're not wanting to create statutory authority to move forward into a task force or something like that. Just us having kind of an informal committee that moves forward. And
I'm not even sure we need a committee. I'm wondering if we can't, as a committee... suggest that the committee, that the department develop the rules. We're directing them to develop these rules.
There you go. Yeah, actually, I think it's not a bad idea to have that conversation, to sit down along that line. I'm not a real fan of doing a mandate with this right now, but I found it interesting what David Fiskum was talking about, his four steps of what Providence has done, you know, to sit down during that discussion to really see how would that fit with all the rest of the hospitals throughout the state as well.
Right.
Representative Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm particularly thinking about Ellen Lowe's testimony, too, with regard to the integration efforts of the mental health system that the department is currently tackling, and perhaps an addendum from this committee that this is a particular issue that needs to be part of that conversation. I know that people are not unaware of the challenges of this situation, and it seems to me that it rolls in nicely with the work that Dr. Harris is doing in terms of the overall integration efforts with the mental health system.
So I think what I'd like to do is invite Grant to meet with other people who might be interested in this issue and come back to us, and invite us to invite you to develop some rulemaking.
Chair Tomei, I'd be happy to.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to point out, I used to be on a hospital board in Seaside, at the Providence Seaside, and I think maybe if we include boards, a member of the hospital boards association, if they have one or two, that would be helpful too. Because I'm with you. If we don't need to do a bill, let's not do a bill. Mm-hmm. And if it's going to put, if we're going to be redundant, as it was starting to appear, listening to testimony, I think that this is a good. You know, it sounds like things are already going
right. So could we call back on you in a couple of weeks and see how things are going, and just contact my office if you feel like things are going okay, if you'd like to meet with us again, if and when you'd like. Well, we're not going to say if. When you want to meet with us again. Was there anything else? Representative Cowan?
Just one quick additional follow-up. Madam Chair, it was recognized that you and I both did visits to hospital emergency rooms during the interim, and because I come from a small community with a small community hospital, I think that it's important to recognize the interest of the hospitals and the hospital boards as well in improving the system that we have right now. The room that they have set aside to care for an individual in a mental health crisis is one of their emergency rooms, and if it needs to be used for an extended period of time for one purpose, that's very complicating. It makes it very difficult within the emergency room to with a regular flow of patients. So it's certainly the hospital's desires to make any improvements we can in the system to move things more smoothly.
Right. This is not seen as a criticism of any hospital.
I just have to say, because I did actually almost make my appointment too, but I did it as a patient instead. So I had a real bird's eye view of how the system works. So it was very interesting.
And haven't we all? Okay, thank you, committee. Thank you, Grant. And thank you all who came here today to share with us. And we'll be hearing from you at a later time. So I'll be closing the public hearing on 2351 and opening up
just a public hearing
on 2134.
This bill, we've heard from the individuals involved before. For contractors engaged in activities involving lead-based paint, it would, as written, remove the licensing authority from the Construction Contractors Board and place it with the Department of Human Services. On the dais this morning, you received a dash two amendment that we picked up just before the meeting this morning, and so the advocates here are seeing it for the first time this morning as well, but I know that they are going to discuss that, and they have discussed just a few revisions to that, but they're going to tell us what they resolved.
All righty. Who do we have? Gail? Oh, there you are. And whomever else, sure.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health. I could use some myself right now.
You sound as healthy as I feel.
Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. I do have some written testimony here. If I may, Madam Chair, just speak conceptually to the dash twos that you have in front of you. I've asked Scott Berry from the Home Builders Association to join me, and Craig Smith, the Administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, is here today as well. I really appreciate the committee's continuing focus and engagement on lead-based paint and lead poisoning and all of the work. The dash twos are, I don't know, pick a number, but maybe 96-97% there, but not every T is crossed and I dotted. And so with the chair's indulgence, we would like to come back a week from today for a fairly quick and efficient work session to move things through in one piece. The amended bill does not do as I think the summary of the bill on the as introduced states. It does not move enforcement from CCB to DHS. What the bill as proposed to be amended would do. You have in front of you there's about 12 items there, and I won't go through necessarily each one, but basically what it does is say for those contractors who are already licensed and regulated by CCB, that those firms who want to do renovation, repair, and painting under this new federal regulation will go to CCB after having been trained through an accredited training program, accredited and overseen by DHS. So DHS does all of the training oversight and accreditation oversight, period. For those firms who are regulated by CCB, they will go to CCB. For those firms who are not regulated by CCB, they will come to DHS. And I was just well, very interested in the issue that you were just dealing with. I did take the time to also look through some of the brand new, since we met the first time, some new EPA rules dated March 20th having to do with some of their fee structure. And they, by way of explaining some of what this rule is to deal with, they identified potentially affected categories of businesses by this new rule include, building construction, specialty trade contractors, real estate firms, child care services, elementary and secondary schools, other technical and trade schools, engineering services, and lead abatement contractors. So you see that there's a mix there. Some are already regulated by the Construction Contractors Board. Others are not. And so we're just following that kind of natural cleavage between those two categories, as it were. So so that's really what the amendments are intended to do. And last but not least, I guess I'll mention that what is both inherent and implicit in the bill and also explicit in the language of the Dash 2s, soon to be next week, the Dash 3s, is that DHS and CCB will continue to work very closely together, reporting enforcement actions that each of us takes to each other so that we can work in a coordinated sort of way. We also propose that any civil penalty that is levied by either agency be plowed back into lead-based paint or lead poisoning prevention efforts so that we can really move forward as a state in dealing with this very serious public health issue. With that, I'll turn to my good and ever closer colleague with the home builders.
Good morning. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders. And I'll just open by saying, again, this is not an Oregon mandate on lead-based paint training. This is something that's already passed the federal level. It's something that Oregon contractors and others are going to need to do no matter what we do here with this legislation. And I think that's part of the reason we're here in support of 2134. And I want to thank Gail for working so hard on trying to find a solution. Our concerns initially, as I talked with some of you about, was how we get that education to the contractor. Can we make it as easy as possible through a local system so that those contractors can get their training through the upcoming continuing education that they're going to be required to take and simply go into the contractor's board either to renew or if they need to prior to the April 2010 date and turn over a certificate that demonstrates they've taken the accredited education from DHS, and that's really it. I think we believe that having the program here in Oregon as opposed to the EPA really gives contractors that ability to find a local provider for training that they can have easy access to and hopefully creates a system that works much better for them. So one other point, I think the civil penalty piece of this legislation was really important to us, and I know for Gail as well. Taking that money from civil penalties, which will occur, and directing it towards lead-based paint education, we really believe, at least from the contractor's point of view, that the real problem here, or the larger problem, I should say, is with the homeowner who just is unaware that there's lead-based paint in their house. And as they get up on a weekend to sand the window seal, they're creating a problem and a hazard they have no idea that they're creating for their family. So I think taking that money and putting it towards that education of just the general population really makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Any questions, this panel? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Scott, thanks for bringing that up, that application. And Gail, thanks for your good work on that, both of you. I've seen that done in some other areas, DEQ fines, et cetera. And when the fine goes to the general fund, it doesn't really make a statement. But when it goes to correct the problem that it was the people received the fine, I think it makes a statement. And it actually does something that's good and helps with the problem. So thank you.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Quickly, does the Dash 2 permit DHS to accredit online training, or does it prohibit?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, it certainly does not prohibit and certainly provides a flexibility to allow.
Thank you.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
and this can be for both of you. I made a note last time. There was a statement made last time that said that Oregon could administer the program for the same amount of money or cheaper than what the federal government could. Is that in this amendment? I had looked at the two, and there really wasn't a discussion about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, I'm not sure it is. We did have a lot of good discussion among various agencies and advocates and others. And I don't know, Scott, do you want to...
Sure. We did talk quite a bit about that, Chair Tomei and Representative Freeman, and I think certainly from the construction industry's point of view, we're very comfortable that the fees will remain lower than what is allowed at the upper end of the federal EPA guidelines, and certainly we can come back after the program is put in place and report to you on that. Happy to do that.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, that's kind of a follow-up then from what Representative Freeman said. This piece that you gave us originally about the fines and then the conversation you just mentioned about the EPA coming out with some different thoughts on, is this still in line with where you're wanting to go, or are you going to have to adjust accordingly?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, I literally was just reading this now. And I believe they only made one change, but as I said, I think next week I can provide more direct information. I do want to draw the committee's attention to, and I may call on Scott's assistance with this. The EPA has identified kind of two categories of fees, if you will. One is offer training providers in order to accredit and oversee assure quality of training providers. We plan to do that as well. The second is for firms to make application to the government entity, whether it's the state or the federal government, and if it's the state, then one of the two agencies. And we plan to do that as well. We are absolutely confident that we can come in certainly no higher than, and we think a significant amount lower than, both of those. When we are now looking at splitting apart, as I said, so that the certification and oversight responsibility, frankly, that leaves public health anemic, no pun intended, in terms of its ability to do its work, because most of the revenue are from firms making application for certification. Since we have premised those numbers on approximately 75% or 80% of those firms would be regulated or will be regulated by CCB already, that takes 75% or 80% of that category of the fee revenue away from DHS. Consequently, what we are talking about is allowing DHS to add a surcharge to individuals taking the training from those accredited training providers, and those training providers passing through that increment, it may be $10 or $20 or something of an increment to DHS to make us whole, so to speak, so that it can be a sustainable program within DHS. I don't want to hide that in any way, but it's a little difficult to explain, I think, any better than that. So to answer both of your very important questions, the categories of fees for which EPA will charge, we expect to come in definitely less. I can't tell you to the penny how much less at this point, but we're absolutely committed. We are looking at this additional increment to be as modest as possible to make sure that DHS is not left with, frankly, a lot of the work and insufficient revenue.
Follow up on that. Okay, thank you. So I take it then when the rulemaking process occurs that you have identified in the -1's sub-6, were you thinking or had you contemplated about inviting Scott to the table with you on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, it would not be a day without sunshine. A day without sky is a day without sunshine. We simply would not do any rulemaking without an absolutely broad, diverse, complete group of participation, including the home builders. Absolutely.
And then I just have one other question, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
That's good. Then I'm thankful that you're looking at him as sunshine. I'm not. Yeah. So, and I don't want this to be a long answer for you, but the enforcement part of it right now, with CCB tied into it for what they do on this type of thing, and it now being handed over toward your division. Where are you going to need to have extra bodies for the enforcement, or are you there already with I'm just trying to kind of get a handle on that.
Sure. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, because of what we're talking about now, of splitting between the two agencies, we really don't need that much more. I'm sorry, I don't think the committee has had an opportunity to look at the amended fiscal impact, and that of course will also be available for you next week. But I think it's something like it's half of what we anticipated with the bill as introduced, because we've got we will have now terrific enforcement assistance from Construction Contractors Board. So they will simply add, I don't want to say simply, but they will add these renovation, repair, and painting pieces to their already ongoing oversight. And so we certainly anticipate, and I think the language anticipates, that they will enforce against those entities for which they have enforcement authority. We will enforce against the entities that are not already licensed and regulated by CCB. So consequently, we don't need that much more.
Okay. Thank you.
I think somebody else had a question. Yeah. Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, thank you. On the front page, number 3 of your little testimony, said you're adding pediatric medical providers. I don't see it in the dash 2. Is it? I'm not. Of course, I just looked for it.
And
I've scoured 3 times now. I don't find it anywhere.
And
my question is, has that conversation occurred with the Oregon Medical Board, the Nursing Board, the Nurse Association, with the OMA about this new requirement?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, thank you for that catch. Actually, if I could draw your attention to page 4, line 8, if that might answer your... Am I looking at something that you don't have?
I'm sorry, line what?
Line 8.
No, there's nothing here.
I'm looking. Do you have the dash twos?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at on page 4, which is section 3. sub 1, sub E, develop and conduct programs to screen blood lead levels, identify hazards, educate the public, including but not limited to parents, residential dwelling owners, pediatric medical providers, and child care facility operators.
Boy, I'm not seeing that. Is anybody else?
Line 3.
Line 3.
Oh,
yeah.
I apologize. I must
okay,
have
I
a
see.
Different
yeah.
printout than you
it's
do. I apologize.
So the follow-up to that is that, are they going to have to take the same training that the contractors?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, no. This simply adds them to the list of folks in terms of outreach.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you for all the work on this. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Does that mean you're wanting to speak when you stand up? Is anyone else here who's wishing to speak on this? All right.
Yes,
thank you so much.
To say.
Hello, Stephen.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori, representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. Just wanted to express our support for the amendments to the bill. We're the ones really on the front line. The remodelers are the people who do most of this work, and we have been in the business of training on lead-based paint. We're very much aware of the problem. We've done this work before. We anticipate doing more of it. I just wanted to thank Senator Gail Shibley for her work and her flexibility on this issue. It's really important that we get a good program out of the hands of the feds and into the state, and I applaud her for doing that. And I want to thank Scott for being the person who got most of this work done in this. And I have to thank him. And I also told him, I said, when I go back to my clients, I told them I did all the work. That's what lobbyists work in this game. I didn't do much of it. I was there supporting Scott all the way. Thank you so much.
Any questions? Seeing none, it's good to see you. Thank you, Stephen. Anyone else who wishes to speak on this issue? All right. So we are going to close the public hearing, and we will have a work session as soon as we get a fiscal. So I'll close the public hearing on 2134. And anything for the good of the order? You're getting off a half hour early. I would like to remind people, if you're going to be late, I'd sure appreciate getting a note. If you're going to be leaving during committee, for any reason, just say you'll be back in 15 minutes or whatever. That would just be really helpful to me. Appreciate that.
That didn't go for bathroom breaks.
No, that's okay. Yes,
I'm going to
find that.
Is that the only reason?
Yes, potty breaks.
Oh, you John.
That's different. I'm sorry, we're not. Oh, wait, just a minute. We'll give you the note. Good enough. Okay, we're still on the record here, so you might want to. Anything else? See you at 8:30 on Monday morning. Close to the House Committee on Human Services.